Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do plans and priorities change from one generation to the next, and what do those changes suggest for U.S. society as a whole? In 1992, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Work-Life Integration Program surveyed graduating seniors about the futures they imagined for themselves, personally and professionally. At the time, nearly 80% reported they planned to someday have children, with just 3% of women and 6% of men saying probably or definitely not. When a similar group of graduating seniors was asked the same question last year, results were starkly different. Just over 40% said they planned to be parents eventually, and nearly 30% said they planned not to be. So what accounts for those changes within the span of just 20 years? Stuart D. Friedman is practice professor of management at the Wharton School and founder of the Work-Life Integration Project. He details survey findings and what they suggest in his new book, Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. Stu, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
So the rate of college graduates who plan to have children has dropped by half in 20 years. How surprising was that shift to you?
I was shocked. When we first looked at our findings, comparing the results of this very extensive survey we did in 1992 with the students who graduated then, with the students who had graduated in 2012, that finding just kind of screamed off the computer screen. I thought, well, no, that can't be right. But indeed, it is right. So, I was shocked, as a number of my colleagues and friends were as well. And that became then the focus of our report and analysis and recommendations that I describe in the book, because it was such a stark and, I think, important finding for our nation, for our companies, and our families.
And it's not just a change, we should make this point, in the number of people, in the number of children people expect to have if they want them, because those numbers have fallen far less. This is an increase in the number of young people who don't think they will ever have children. Can you talk to us about why it's important to make that distinction?
Yeah, well, the family size, expected family size for the people who are planning to have children didn't change at all. It's like 2.5 or 2.6 on average. What's different now is that many fewer people are planning to actually have or adopt children. And furthermore, the other important distinction here is that many people still value the idea of being a parent as a part of life, as an important part of life, as a significant aspect of the human experience. What's changed is how young people view the prospect of actually being able to do it.
So it starts to feel not undesirable, but impossible to some people.
Exactly. Or just very, very challenging and perhaps not worth it.
What's the relationship between family planning among college graduates and plans for family among people with lower levels of academic achievement? I mean, how much can we extrapolate your studies at Wharton?
That's a great question. And the trends that we observed seem to parallel what others have studied, people who are more expert in the whole field of population demography, which I'm not a demographer. This is not why I got into the study. I'm an organizational psychologist, and what we were looking for was how people have changed in terms of their values, their aspirations, and how they're thinking about the relationship between work and family life. But the findings that we observed seem to parallel what others who study these things nationally and internationally, what they have observed as well. And when you think about the students here at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, these are kids, if I can call them that, who have all the opportunity in the world. They're smart, they're well-resourced, they're well-educated. If they're struggling to see how they can make it work, it seems to me that that's a conservative test of the idea that, it's harder now. It's a lot harder now for young people to think about how to create families of their own, because it's got to be easier for them than for the average American citizen.
You write that these changes reflect both new constraints felt by this generation, but also new possibilities. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, the main thing there has to do with greater freedom of choice that young people seem to be expressing. So on the one hand, people of my generation, I'm 61, are kind of distressed in wondering, like, when am I going to have grandchildren already? I've got three kids in their 20s, mm-hmm. and that's a question that's very much on my mind personally. But the greater freedom that we see is, especially for young women, this could be the first generation in history where women are able to say, yeah, being a parent, that sounds like it would be really useful and fun for me in terms of my life experience, but I don't have to do that. Hmm. I don't feel compelled to march mindlessly into motherhood like virtually every other generation of women has felt extreme pressure to do. These young women seem to be able to make that choice consciously and deliberately, whether or not we like it, without the same sense of guilt or pressure, social pressure, to conform to a traditional stereotype of what a woman is supposed to do. So that's on the women's side. It's a little different on the men's side.
For men, the identity as sort of being a man includes being a caretaking father has shifted somewhat.
Exactly. And this is, again, I think, an indication of greater freedom, where young men are able to say, I want to be an engaged father. I want to play a role in domestic life. And my views about what I expect of my family life, my spouse, are different than my father's views in a way that respects and endorses the idea of women's full engagement in life outside the home, in careers, in public life.
Hmm. So,
I was just going to add that the other aspect that I think gives, sheds a ray of hope into these otherwise pretty depressing findings is that men and women are now more aligned in their views about what it takes to make a family work, what it takes to make a dual career relationship work. They tend to be more in agreement now than they were 20 years ago about when one partner, or whether or not, and when one partner needs to be at home in order to care for children. So men are much more egalitarian today, much more believing in a 50-50 model of shared responsibility. And women, interestingly, are less strident about that and more willing to yield to the notion that, well, gee, if I'm going to have kids, then I want to be there.
Hmm. Yeah, I was interested in sort of the things that people told you, women in particular, about their thoughts on whether their male partner's career ought to be the primary one in the relationship.
Say the first part of that again?
Whether the male partner in heterosexual couples, women were talking about whether they would be willing to sort of let their partner's job be the more important job in the relationship.
Yeah, they're more likely to say that that's, something that they accept today than they were, the Gen Xers were 20 years ago.
Do you think that's a reflection maybe of Gen Xers still coming out of the baby boom generation and having had a lot closer relationship to people who sort of fought for those freedoms for women?
That's a great point, Chris. I think that is true. But I think the more powerful influence here is that the millennials, the class of 2012, they have seen their mothers and fathers and, the women a generation before them outside of their families, they've seen them struggle. A number of them told stories in our interviews of, for example, one graduate talking about at her summer internship at a bank, a woman executive on a Friday night at 10 o'clock has her three kids in her office and, while they're playing video games and she's trying to get work done. This is not a model that she wanted to follow. So I think it's a combination of what you say, the Gen Xers being closer to my generation, in which women had to struggle to emerge from, much more restrictive roles in society. And it's also a matter of, you know, the millennials seeing how difficult it has been for the women just above them.
Did you see any particular patterns, Stu, in millennials' answers depending on the structure of the families they themselves had grown up in?
The only thing that we saw that was noteworthy there was that was the observation about men and whether or not their mother was employed. For the Gen Xer men, if your mom worked when you were young, you were more likely to, or if your mom was at home when you were young, you were more likely to plan to become a parent yourself. But that distinction was not true for the class of 2012, the millennials, either for men or for women, because it became a lot more normal. There was only 15% of the class of 1992 whose mothers were employed when the child was young, in the first few years of life, whereas that number went up by threefold for the class of 2012. So it became a lot more normal.
To what extent did money and debt influence millennials' desires and expectations for the future?
Well, for men, if you, as a young man, if you carry a lot of student debt leaving college, you are less likely to feel confident enough to be able to say, yes, I plan to have kids. So the more debt you carry, the less likely it is that you're planning to have children as a man, not for women. On the other hand, to the extent that you feel financially insecure, as a woman, you're likely to push out in time the age at which you plan to have children, if you're going to.
And, of course, the further back you push it, the fewer children you are likely to have.
That's probably true. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I didn't look at that connection, but it's a good point. And these are great questions, Chris.
Thank you. And debt is a bigger issue for younger people, in part because college is more expensive, but also because there are, I mean, I just read something about Pell Grants used to cover like 60% of the cost of a college education, and now it's, you know, half that or something. And other kinds of grants and loans are ultimately more costly to the individual.
The cost of college is now a national, you know, urgent issue, as I'm sure many of your listeners can relate. When I went to college at State University of New York at Binghamton in the early 70s, with a very small amount of loans and some, you know, scholarship awards that I'd gotten as a lower middle class person from New York City, I was able to pay my way through. I worked on the summers and during holiday breaks. But I didn't carry a lot of debt coming out of school. It was not really a major issue that I worried about. Today, it's a crisis, and it's having a serious impact on the life plans of our young people. The cost of education has gone up radically, and the cost of loans has gone up. And there are a number of our legislators and public officials who are trying to change that.
My guest is Stuart D. Friedman, practice professor of management at the Wharton School and author of the new book Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. We'd love to hear your perspective on this, and you're also welcome to ask questions by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stuart D. Friedman. He's practice professor of management at the Wharton School and author of the new book, Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you mentioned the importance of work early on. It seems that today's graduates expect to have more, perhaps, unpaid work leading to their first job. How much does that affect the amount of debt they get into, the amount of early earning they're able to do, and does that affect their belief that parenthood will be an option for them?
What we see is that it's expected now that young people will spend their summers while they're in college investing their time in internships and really getting going on their career life, if we can call it that, sooner. So young people today are just more conscious of the need to compete and to get on that fast track as quickly as possible. There's just greater pressure. And keep in mind that this is the generation that hit adolescence at the time of 9/11, and began college. This particular cohort began college at the very start of the Great Recession. So they experience a lot of uncertainty in their lives and insecurity. And so that further compels them to want to secure their economic future and to start sooner.
Well, let's talk. Continue. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Let's talk about adolescence, because I actually graduated from college in 1992, not from Wharton, but and I was no special standout. But as soon as I finished school, I was able to sort of earn my own living. I was in what we call a real job, which seems more challenging for people who are just out of undergraduate today. And I wonder if maybe 22-year-olds today, as bright and hardworking as they are simply not in the same place in their life development, and therefore their answers are different about what they intend for their relationships and their ability to be parents later on. Would it make more sense to ask them at 25?
That's a really good point, Chris. And I think that the age of emergence into adulthood has gotten higher. And there's a lot of people writing about, extended adolescence and dependency of young people today on their parents who reciprocally are perhaps, holding on too long. I don't know exactly how to answer that other than to say that it seems to be true that, there is this phenomenon of extended adolescence and greater dependency. And so, a 22-year-old today is not really the same as a 22-year-old 20 years ago. They are, in a sense, perhaps, developmentally younger.
And they are more bonded, this is interesting, to their families of origin than
right.
The Gen Xers.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the sources of evidence for that in our study, that we ask about how people feel about the families they came from and the families that they're planning to create, if they are. And indeed, the millennials report that their families of origin, their parents, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, et cetera, are more important to them than in comparison to the people 20 years ago.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Let's go on the phone now to Martin in Arlington. Hey, Martin.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am 36 years old, and many of the people I grew up with are rich kids. And I'm wondering, of having that experience of coming home, not having your parents there until they come home, sometimes even having to cook their own dinners and so on, and then for themselves, I'm wondering how that's affecting younger people's decisions in terms of work-life balance for their families or family planning.
Thanks for your call. It was a little hard to hear Stu at first, but Martin was asking about latchkey kids and the effects of that on future plans.
Yeah, I think that's part of why, that's part of the reasoning for why young people today are less likely to plan to have kids of their own, because they don't want to recapitulate that same experience. they are more aware of what it takes and more conscious of the need for somebody to be there as a parent, as a caretaker for young children, and are willing to forsake the obligation if they feel they can't fulfill it. So, I think that's definitely a part of how young people are thinking about this issue.
What do millennials want from their jobs to the extent that it differs from what Gen Xers were hoping for?
Well, one of the main changes that we saw in comparing, you know, what's important in your career, what's important in your life, is in the interest in helping other people, especially for women. So young women today are significantly more interested than the young women from 20 years ago in doing work that helps others, and that has a positive social impact. And indeed, the more you feel that this is important to you as a young woman, the less likely it is that you are yourself planning to have children of your own. So it's almost as if these young women are making a trade between serving the family of humanity and creating a family with children of their own.
Do they perceive it to be almost selfish to invest that kind of energy and talent in their own children as opposed to the community?
Well, this is another pretty hot issue that you've just raised. There are a number of young people, men and women, who I've since the, you know, the book has been out and we're having many interesting conversations on campus about these results and what they mean. And we're actually creating there's a group of students that are creating a discussion guide for the book that we're hoping students in other schools around the country will use to help create a new conversation about what these findings mean in terms of where we are as a society and what it means for you as an individual and crafting your future. In the focus groups and informal discussions that I've been a part of, one of the things that I've heard and that I write some about in the implications section of the book is the notion that to have children of your own in today's world is indeed a selfish act, because there are so many children who need to be cared for in the world who are not presently. So why not invest your resources and attention in taking care of those kids rather than creating new ones who might not, you know, have all the attention that they need either, given, you know, the other things that you're doing with your life. So, yeah, there is a movement of a sector of society, young people thinking that it's better to adopt, it's better to, you know, spend your time trying to heal this broken world than it is to, you know, populate it further.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Doug in Rockwall. Hello, Doug.
Yes, good afternoon. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, I've got a question. All of my roommates in college, I got out in the early 80s. I went to a small liberal arts college, and boy, the thing to do was to go to med school. And I had three roommates. They all went, they're all different kinds of doctors now. But I've read a study here where in Texas, for the last several years, they're noticing a trend. There used to be a fairly high correspondence between folks entering medical school that had one or both of their parents as a physician. And that trend seems to be unraveling now, and they think it's because they've heard 18 years of gripes from their parents about how tough it is to be a doctor in today's world. And I'll take the answer offline, but I'm wondering if that lines up with your experience in researching for the book. I know the MCAT scores required to get, Texas has five or six medical schools, and they're lowering the standards in order to fill those seats now.
Really?
Are there any other professions that are undergoing this kind of a transformation?
That's really interesting. Thanks for your call, Doug.
Well, I wasn't aware of that, Doug, so thanks for bringing that to my attention. I think that there are a number of careers and industries that are undergoing significant transformation. And certainly, you know, I know anecdotally that the medical world is just a lot tougher today than it was when I was growing up. I think the financial services industry, which is one that, you know, here in Philadelphia at the Wharton School we're more familiar with, is also undergoing a significant culture shift or pressures to shift and to be more actively serving social needs and creating value for society, for the world, as well as containing what many experience as overly inclusive or oppressive work conditions, work hours. So one of the findings in our study for comparing the class of 92 to the class of 2012 was in the number of hours expected to be working. In 1992, that average of people going, you know, directly into employment, not school, was 56 or 58 hours per week. For the class of 2012, it jumped to 72 hours per week. That's almost 2 days extra per week, if you think of an eight-hour day, that that we've seen in the last 20 years. And many of these people are going into the fields of banking or consulting. So I think both of those fields are seriously looking at how they can create greater flexibility, greater control, and less intrusion of work into other parts of life.
And you suggest that in creating greater flexibility, companies also need to address the ongoing stigma in asking for flexibility.
Yeah, there's been some very important research recently that shows how the request for flexibility or taking an alternate track in terms of the time investment in career carries a penalty, carries a career penalty. It's probably not surprising to most listeners, but it's been demonstrated. And that's something that companies are going to have to fight hard against if we're going to create new models that are legitimate and fruitful for people who want to have a different kind of career. And that's what I see as the exciting part of what's happening today, is that there are companies wrestling with this, and there are many individuals and families creating new models and really wrestling with experiments in how they can live and work that enables them to have the kind of lives that they want, that's good for them and good for their families and society. And so we're seeing the emergence of different forms. The standard of the prior generation or two of mom at home, dad at work somewhere outside of the home, and a couple of kids at home with mom. All of our social institutions, or at least most of them, and our business practices are built around that model. The thing is, that model just isn't normal anymore. And so the crunch, of course, is that we're in this period of transition, and that's what's exciting, is that we're seeing new models emerging. But it's painful and very, very difficult for most of us to try to be a part of that change. But there are things that we can do, and that's what I spend the back half of the book focusing on, what we can do as a society, in our organizations, and for ourselves and our families.
We have an email here from Zach who says, my wife and I are in our early 30s and elected in our early 20s not to have children. We are happy with our decision and the life it allows us to have. Would you expand on why you consider these findings to be depressing?
they're depressing to the extent, and it's more that I hear this from other people saying to me, wow, that's depressing. I'm an optimist by nature, and I look for the signals of human evolution in these data that I see as positive. But many people look at this and say, ugh, what is the problem here that so many people are opting out of having children? I think Zach, I applaud Zach's decision. I'm glad he's happy. That's fantastic. And I think more and more people are choosing that form of family life, where friends and networks are more important now than having children of your own. That was another thing that we found in terms of what people value at work now that's different than 20 years ago. Friendships and social networks and professional networks are more important today than they were in the past. The depressing part is that there are many people who would like to have children, but don't see how they can do it. And that's sad. And that's something that we also, in the long run for our society, we can't afford. So that's why we need major investments in upgrading our child care system, which is right now seen as kind of Neanderthal by our friends in Europe, because it is. And I think this is a national tragedy and is going to blow up in our faces a generation hence. And other changes that we can make in terms of supporting family medical leave. There are many things that we can do at a social policy level that will make it easier for people to have the wherewithal to be able to pursue their passions as potential parents. The sad part is that some people, a good chunk of at least our sample, would like to be parents, but they don't see how they can do it.
One of the suggestions you make is relieving students of burdensome debt, by which you're referring to student debt, not credit cards and that sort of thing. Can you talk about why that would make such a difference?
Well, in conversations like this that I've had, and many like this since the book came out a couple of months ago, one of the things that I hear, and it's certainly something that we saw in our study, is that the burden of student debt makes it just harder to afford the costs of children. And if we can provide more support for deserving and interested people in their advancing their education and make it easier for them to pay off their debts, they're going to have more resources to deal with the costs of child-rearing. The big one of which, of course, is child care. Because we don't have a decent system of social support for children, particularly the youngest children, because many parents have to spend huge chunks of their salary or their income on child care, the young people who are looking forward and doing the math are thinking, I don't see how I can afford it.
Stuart D. Friedman is my guest. His new book is called Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stuart D. Friedman, practice professor of management at the Wharton School and author of the new book Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Stu, I have to say, I wanted to stand up and cheer when I read the section of the book where you suggest that another remedy for all of this is that we need to stop considering work-life balance and the need for affordable child care to be women's issues. These are human issues, and they affect men as much as women.
Absolutely. This issue has been relegated to the women's ghetto in companies for far too long. And another piece of good news that I think is now a part of the national conversation is that men are a part of it and see and feel the need for change as keenly as do women. In fact, for men, it's even more challenging, some might say, because the transition in men's roles in society is perhaps even more abrupt. Young men today expect that their spouses will be fully engaged in career. Young men today no longer see themselves as the primary breadwinner. And they anticipate greater conflict between their work lives and their family lives, and are just kind of figuring out, like, what does it mean for me to be a man in today's society? So it's very much an issue that affects all of us. And again, you know, people like me speaking about this, not just women, but men too, speaking about these issues, doing research and helping, you know, organizations and individuals to change is far overdue, I think. And I can tell you that over the course of my career, you know, in tracking these issues and being involved in this movement for 25 years, it's a really different story right now. When I first got into this, I had colleagues saying to me, you know, Stu, why are you wasting your time on this women's issue? It's really not something that, you know, you've got other things that you could be doing with your career. And now it's kind of normal for both men and women to be tackling these questions and trying to create new models that work for both men and women and for families.
Do you think that rather sudden redefining of the role of men in our society has anything to do with the fact that you observe that millennial women report themselves to be happier overall than millennial men, and that's a difference that doesn't exist among Generation X?
You know, I don't know all the reasons for that, but your theory makes a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, when I say this out loud in front of women's groups, they just kind of roll their eyes and say, yeah, right, it's so much harder for women. And indeed, most of the questions that we ask about, you know, who has it easier, for whom is it easier to have it all, everyone, not everyone, but most people agree that it's still a man's world, and that things are easier for men. Indeed, there was a recent study that from the Pew Research Center, I think just yesterday, that affirmed the same idea, that it remains easier. That said, there's much greater parity now on things like income. So our men and women in our study, at least in the early part of their careers, they expect to make the same amount of money, which is different than 20 years ago. So there have been some real significant gains for women, and at the same time, it's become more challenging, more uncertain for young men. And so perhaps that's part of the reason why women are happier.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Lauren in Dallas. Hey, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show. I was just going to comment on most of the women my age. I mean, I'm 24 in Dallas. I live in Uptown. We're just so focused on ourselves that we have no time to focus on anything else. We don't care about getting married, settling down. We just want the instant gratification. And that's mostly what I see in all the people in my age group. And I was just wondering what you had to say about that.
Thanks, Virgil.
You said it, Lauren, not me. Yeah, there's a number of people who've read this book and kind of concluded something similar. And indeed, the finding that we had about how young women view the relationship between their personal health and their interests in having children is quite striking on this point. So 20 years ago, the more you valued your personal physical health, the more likely it was that you were planning to have children, to become a mother, because women then saw a positive connection between health and motherhood. In 2012, that inverted so that young women today think about their personal health as antagonistic to becoming a mother. So it's almost as if young women today would rather be fit than pregnant. And I think this is consistent with what Lauren is saying, that there is much greater interest now among young women in their friends, in doing good in the world, but not in creating families of their own, at least not yet. So, you know, the wheel is still in spin, and we'll see how this turns out for this generation. But Lauren's, lifestyle, as she described it briefly, I think is pretty typical.
We should know that it's not mutually exclusive that one can be fit and pregnant simultaneously.
Of course, of course. I'm just telling you what I've heard.
Right, right.
Please do reemphasize that. Yes, of course. But I'm just saying that the data seem to suggest that many young women don't see it that way.
Stu, do we have reason to worry in this country if, you know, people like recent Wharton grads who, as you mentioned, you know, will likely out-earn people who have less education later on, if the sort of elite of American society with regard to academic achievement and earnings choose to have fewer children, what does this world look like 20 or 30 years from now?
Yes, that's a really good question, Chris. And, you know, one can only speculate, but, you know, we want to have the best and the brightest continuing to bear children for sure. And so I guess what you're getting at here is if the elites are not procreating and everybody else is there going to be a degradation in, you know, the quality of our population? And I don't know.
Well, I want to be careful about how I state this. I certainly don't mean to imply that anybody can have a great kid and raise a great kid. But you know, elites, if you want to use that word, and I used it, I'm referring, I suppose, to the resources, material resources that they mm-hmm. are able to give their children are an advantage.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure what else to say about that other than, you know, for what I would like to see more of is freedom to choose the kind of life you want to choose, for men to choose how they want to live, whether it's with or without children, with or without spouses, and for women the same. My belief is that the more real choices people have, the happier everyone's going to be, and indeed the more productive our society will be. And that's what we need to build towards, is the support for people to choose to have kids, for those who want to, because, of course, not everybody who does have children should have children. So many people have children because it's expected of them, not because they want to.
Right.
And this is where I see the opportunity, is that young women especially, but men too, are choosing to either pursue or not pursue parenthood in a more conscious way, without being, constrained by stereotypes. Another finding we observed along these lines is the impact of religion. So people are much more likely to report now, at least at this school, and I think this mirrors national trends, that they are, they identify as agnostic or atheist, many more. So it's up to like 25%. And for women, to the extent that you identify as agnostic or atheist, you are less likely to plan to have children of your own. And the implication there is that, most religions have prescriptions and prescriptions about what women and men, of course, should do with their lives. And if you are free of those prescriptions, you're less likely to, to be constrained by them in terms of, you know, your role as a mother. So there's greater freedom. And again, I think that in general, this is what we want to promote in society.
How have expectations changed with regard to whether young men and women expect to enter into a long-term relationship, marriage when it's available, or a sort of domestic partnership when it's not?
Yeah, that hasn't changed. It's pretty much the same. People are still planning to pair off, and those numbers—it's a slight dip, but it's still like, well over 80%, like 84 or 85%. So most people still plan to be in long-term relationships or marriage.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Fatima on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Fatima.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just had a couple of comments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 26 years old, and I have a whole lot of student debt, just like every other person. Also, I would like to have children someday. At least I think so. But the way things are going, it doesn't look very well. So I just feel this ginormous pressure of having to get all my stuff done career-wise and everything by the time I'm 30 just so I can have children. But then also with the other point that y'all were talking about, our uncertainty, men or women, makes us kind of, it's difficult to get into the relationship to even produce children. So just even if you choose to have a child at, I guess, as a millennium, it's really difficult because of the career uncertainties, because of the relationships and how hard they are to get into and sustain, because of the student loans that are crushing, and it's just all together just frustrating. And I don't really know what the solution is. It's just really stressful, and I would say it is depressing, honestly, because it makes me want to just cry just thinking about it. I don't know. So hopefully by the time I'm 30, I would kind of figure it out.
Well, thanks for your call. It sounds like Fatima really reflects a lot of what you heard from the students that you surveyed last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's so sad to hear this, but this is common. And I really appreciate the call and your candor in sharing your story. Can I stay with you for a moment and ask what would make it easier for you?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What would make it easier for you?
The student loans are pretty much crushing. Like, I'm paying them back now, even though I'm kind of in the beginning still of my career. And they're like $500 a month, and it's just, I think, yeah, the student loan thing, because I don't think we were educated enough about the cost-benefit analysis of taking out a student loan, honestly.
You weren't. I agree.
I feel like because our parents didn't have to go through that. I'm from Sudan, so even though our parents came from a different country and a poorer one, but my dad pretty much had his college paid by the state. So, and then he had scholarships in England, so he never really had to deal with all of
this.
And neither did my mother, because she lived with her family when she went to college. They didn't really have to pay for it. So they don't have no understanding of what it's really going to cost me.
Well, let me jump in. We just have about 30 seconds left, Fatima, so I want Stu to be able to respond.
Well, I think she hit the nail on the head. We need to provide support from our government to help people get through college without having this crushing student debt. You heard it right here, and this is a typical case of how people are unable to see how they can afford kids because they're paying off their college loans.
Any plans to follow these folks, say, 10 years down the line and see how much of their predictions for themselves have come true?
Well, we did that with the class of 1992. So in 2012, we not only surveyed the class of 2012, we also went back to those same people in 1992 and got several hundred of them to fill out a very comprehensive survey. And that's the next project, is to mine that data. One of the things that I did look at immediately, though, was to see whether their predictions about whether they were going to have kids turned out to be true. And for most people, those predictions were accurate.
I have to jump in here because we're out of time, but I can't wait to see that next project. Stuart D. Friedman is author of Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. Stu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. And I should say that it's available now for $1.99 on Kindle.
Great
to
know.
Amazon.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Shelley Canavy is engineer. And I am Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.